Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Senek, here, of course, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. All right, Victor, you had a column up this week about Donald Trump's presidential campaign. Let me just start here. As somebody who is so immersed in the history of the classical world, especially Greece, you know a thing or two about the passions of democracies, for good or for ill. One of the most common knocks on Trump is that he is, in essence, a demagogue. Would you co-sign on that sentiment, or is that a little too facile a characterization?
Well, there's elements, and the reason people say that is twofold, and that is when you look back at an Alcibiades in classical Athens, or somebody like Catiline especially, or Claudius or Milo, or even at Mark Antony, tribunes of the people in Rome, they tend to be from the upper classes, and the idea is that they are shut out, or they don't find it wise, or for whatever reason they don't run in accordance with their economic interests, but they leapfrog over the middle class, who they have contempt for, that want to aspire to be wealthy, and they champion the mob. And we have these stereotype words, even in Latin and Greek, to identify not just the common people, the plebs, but the turba, the wild, dangerous. I guess we don't have a word in English anymore that is anything akin to rabble. In Greek, it's oklos. It's just a negative, pejorative word. And so I think what the criticism of Trump is, he's jumping over the establishment of his own class and even maybe the upper middle class, and he's appealing to these fed-up, lower middle class, prejudicial, stereotyping Republicans. I don't quite see that that's a fair analysis, but that's what people are criticizing him for, and they're doing that because he has one-liners. He's very brilliant in the ad lib, quip, the put down, but he doesn't outline a systematic, analytical agenda that has a real chance of becoming law. At least that's what the establishment thinks. He likes chaos, in other words, chaos for the sake of chaos.
It's interesting that at the same time that Trump has made a big impact, elsewhere in the Republican field, you've got a surge in support for Carly Fiorina, another business person who's never held office. Ben Carson's doing well. He's a neurosurgeon, never held office. Democrats were floating the idea last week of Howard Schultz, the Starbucks CEO, running for the presidency. And we've seen a lot of people in the last few years, especially governors, elected from business backgrounds rather than political backgrounds. What do you make of the fact that there seems to be something of a pushback against what we might call the sort of professional political class?
Yeah, I think the same thing happened in antiquity. There was something called the cursus honorum, and it said, you know, you have to be a prefect or a tribune or a pontifex, and then you got to be a senator and then a consul. And you had to go through that cursus step by step. And by the end of the middle of the empire, you had military commanders from Africa or Spain that were just saying, not for me. And the empire is global now. And I think there's a lot of people in the United States who really don't either know what a senator is or a governor, or don't really feel that it's anything important. And in this buzz world of ours, when they hear somebody talk, they say, well, why not that person? He sounds better than Harry Reid, or he's better than Mitch McConnell, or Trump can come up with ideas just as easily as John Boehner. So it's just there's no requisites. There's no requisites just to participate in the internet. If I go on the internet and I comment on the Peloponnesian War, nobody cares whether I have a PhD from Stanford or I've written three books on it. Just a blogger in his proverbial pajamas can say, you're an idiot. And there's something good about that. And the same thing has finally hit politics. It's just the moment. We don't care about your requisites. We don't care about who you were. We just want to see how you perform in this visual society of ours. And the one other irony about it is they keep talking about the Republican establishment in this race, but there is no Republican establishment other than Jeb Bush. If you and I had this conversation just, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago, Rand Paul, firebrand Tea Party that nobody thought could ever be elected without political experience. Ted Cruz, the wild-eyed extremist, Marco Rubio just came out of nowhere. Carly Fiorina, we know Ben Carson, but even Rick Perry was considered a Texan that was a little weird. Who's the establishment? Jeb Bush, Rick Santorum, Lindsey Graham? It's very few. So Trump is not, when they say he's running against the establishment, what he's basically doing, he's running along with the Tea Party outliers, but he's doing it with skills that they don't have, that he's fascinating to watch. He's funny. He's vicious. He says things that we would never imagine anybody would actually say. And he says things, and this is the $64,000 question. He says things that, like every demagogue, that have an element of truth. So people wouldn't think that he could get away with saying that about John McCain, but there were a lot of people who secretly, privately would never say it, but they were tired of hearing, I was a captive, I was a POW for 30 years. Nobody ever would say publicly that Megyn Kelly is anything other than a brilliant journalist, a lawyer, a legitimate, intelligent, educated person. But on the other hand, they have watched her play on her sensuality with her tan, her hair, her short revealing skirts. And then he comes along and implies she's a bimbo. She's not, but there's an element there that's getting a little bit tired of the blonde bombshells on Fox who say, we're just like any male. And we don't play on our gender. They do. And so what he does is he finds that little seam and then he takes a pickaxe and breaks it apart, and people enjoy that. It's not an agenda. It's not a prescription for governance. It's not sustainable. But right now it's amusing.
Well, to that point, in the piece that you recently did on Trump, you wrote, I'm quoting you here, without detail, Trump derides President Obama's Iran pact in buffoonish terms as if he's judging a bad deal on The Apprentice. But is he wrong? If the Iranian theocracy sincerely plans to stop uranium enrichment, dismantle centrifuges, ensure anytime, anywhere inspections, and stop exporting terrorism, why then are Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and most moderate Middle Eastern nations against the deal, and China and Russia for it? End quote. So, Victor, my question here, does this seem to you to fit with the populist angle? And what I mean by that is we were told until probably – about a year ago, around the time we started seeing ISIS beheadings, that the public was war weary and that the American people just didn't have the stomach for a fight, seemingly regardless of the merits. Does the tide seem to you to have turned on that? Are we perhaps not as gun shy anymore when it comes to the use of American power?
The short answer is yes, because it's been a while. It's been people have not died abroad since 2007 in the surge. People forget when Obama came into power in 2009, we had months that were only three people dying, less than the accident rate in the military. We're only dying in Iraq. So it's been a while. But then Iran may get a nuclear weapon, and that's different because when you say nuclear, you think of attacking Los Angeles or destroying New York. So that's a new level of anxiety. And one of the things that Trump has done is the two things, actually. One is, and every one of these issues that he's demagoguing, he's on the right side of public opinion. Public opinion polls every day worse and worse for the president on Iran. It's not positive on Obamacare. It's not positive for the president on amnesty and open borders. And Trump knows that. So when he says these things, he realizes that 51% plus agree with him. And that, and then all of these things can be, I guess, synthesized into a deal. He always says, just think of deal making, and that's the answer to it. Illegal immigration is a deal between Mexico and us, and they took us. Obamacare is a deal between the insurance company and the government. They took us. Iran is a deal between the theocracy and us, and they took us. And that binary is very simple, and it works to a deal maker's advantage.
I want to go back to that question of immigration for a second because, of course, insofar as substance as opposed to style has played a role in Trump's rise, that's the issue that has really pushed him to the fore. And I think it's fair to say that there's a broad swath of Republicans who feel like they've been jerked around on that topic in the past. How do you respond to the argument that's been made in certain corners of the GOP for at least a decade now that they're making against Trump and anybody else who shares his views on the issue, broadly speaking, that the demographics are dispositive on this question and that for the Republican Party to be a successful party in the future, they're going to have to embrace some form of amnesty for illegal immigrants?
Well, it's ahistorical because if I say Cuomo and I see Giuliani, we don't know what they're going to be like politically based on their ethnic surname. The same thing was happening with Hispanics. Two or three generations, the people I grew up with, they're hard to calibrate and they don't speak Spanish and many of them are intermarried. One out of every four Latinos is intermarrying. What are they then? What are their children then? In my family, I don't know what my sister-in-law or my niece and nephews are. They don't really consider themselves Latinos unless there's some edge in the federal government for job or hiring or admission. So the answer was to close the borders, to let in people from all over the world based on ethnic blind skill sets and let the engine of the melting pot work. If you don't do that and you pander and you let in a million unassimilated people from central Mexico, very different group than 30 years ago, from the people from indigenous people from Oaxaca, they're very hard to assimilate because many of them don't speak Spanish well. When they come up here, then they're a block. They live together. They work together. They're on federal assistance together. And they're useful to the La Raza elite. And they say, look, this latest study says California healthcare is disproportionate on the basis of race. Look, 70% of Latinos are below the poverty. Well, yes, you let in a million of them from central Mexico. What do you want, instant parity in a year? So the problem is that in the short term, they're going to take a big hit. But if they close the borders and they have legal immigration based on ethnic identification as secondary and skills as primary, then they'll be okay. But they don't seem to get that. And they're pandering to the Latino vote, and they're never going to win the Latino vote because people forget that if you're a young Latino and somebody offers you affirmative action and race-based preferences in hiring and 60% of the California DMV employees are Latino, then you're not going to say, gee, I like this Republican agenda. It's just not going to happen. And then what's going to happen is that there's not going to be a whole influx of Latinos, and they're going to have to intermarry with Asians and blacks and whites, and then race becomes incidental. And you really see this when in the Republican establishment, because these are the people who pontificate and lecture when their kids are in private schools. They hang around with white people. They think they're an expert. They're really influenced by corporate employment considerations. And believe me, if they were on ground zero and saw what is happening with unassimilated huge influxes of people from Oaxaca and how they vote and how they look at America, I think they would be sorely disappointed.
So, final question. There's been a fair amount of hand-wringing within the Republican Party of late over how to actually treat Donald Trump. There are people who think you have to proactively marginalize him. We saw Rand Paul go after him pretty aggressively in the first Republican debate. Some people have even suggested that he should be shut out of future debates. And then there are others who say, you know what? Just get out of the way. Let him flame out on his own. In your judgment, what's the right way for Republicans to handle this?
I think your last suggestion is the proper one with a minor qualification is you cannot out-showboat Donald Trump. You will lose every time you get in a war of words with him, not because he's a buffoon, because he's a brilliant showman at repartee. He's clever. He's funny. He's amusing. That's what he wants to happen. So what you need to do is say to your constituency, the Republican Party, Trump is absolutely to be congratulated for bringing up the question of illegal immigration, but he's all over the board. Here's what I want to do. He wants Mexico to play for the wall. We laugh at that. Actually, it's a good idea. $50 billion in remittances are sent back by illegal aliens. Let's just tax 10%. Presto, we get $5 billion a year. In 5 years, we pay for the wall. Why should they send money back from Mexico without a surtax when we're taxing people at 50% on their income here? In every single proposal that Trump makes, he can be co-opted by a similarly outlier like a Cruz or a Rubio or a Fiorina, but with specifics that channel his anger. But they cannot, and that's what he's not good at. So you got to do what you're good at and he's bad at, and you got to stop doing what you're bad at and what he's good at. And Rand Paul was flattened. Lindsey Graham was flattened. John McCain was flattened by Trump. Megyn Kelly, I think, who's very sophisticated and clever, she was flattened by Trump because he says things that even I know that your audience and you and I, we don't particularly think that he'd be a good president, but we find ourselves laughing and say, my God, I can't believe he said that. And there's, as I said, there's a kernel of truth into what everything he says. I think Megyn Kelly, as I said earlier, is brilliant, but there is a stereotype of a fox blonde bombshell who wears revealing clothing to get an extra edge in a way that her male counterpart can't do. And he tapped into that with that crude, you know, sort of bimbo imagery, but nevertheless, he got away with it because he exaggerated a truth and made it into the capital T truth. And that's what demagogues do. They don't make up things out of whole cloth.
All right. That's all the time we have for today. Join us next week for the next installment of the Classicist Podcast. And in the meantime, stop by hoover.org where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.